Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Hello everyone, welcome back to Talking Tudors, Episode 7. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger, and joining me today to talk all things Henry VIII and his six wives is Dr. Susanna Lipscomb. Dr. Lipscomb is Reader in Early Modern History at the University of Roehampton and a Fellow of the Royal Historical Society. She received her Doctor of Philosophy in History from Balliol College in Oxford, writes a column for History Today, and has presented historical documentaries on the BBC, ITV, Channel 5 and National Geographic Channel. She's also the author and editor of six books about the 16th century. My conversation with Susanna straight after this musical break, courtesy of singer-songwriter Carlene. The song, The Raven, is from The Ballad of Anne Boleyn, Carlene's best-selling album, inspired by the life of Henry VIII's second queen consort, Anne Boleyn.
Thank you.
Welcome to Talking Tutors, Susanna. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Really pleased to be here to chat with you.
Oh, I'm so honoured to have you on the show. Now, I don't know if you remember this, but the first time that I interviewed you for On the Tutor Trail was actually in February 2011.
I do remember it vividly, yeah, I do. It's been a long time we've been talking to each other.
It has, hasn't it? And it's really lovely to chat. So a lot has happened since then. Your career has just gone from strength to strength. And I must say, it's been such a pleasure and really inspiring to watch this unfold. And now, while I imagine that most people that have an interest in Tudor history have heard of you and know of your excellent books and the many television programs that you've written and presented, I'd really love it if you could just share a little bit about your background and how you came to be interested in the Tudors.
Well, thank you. Okay, so my background is I grew up just outside London, mm-hmm. and actually just down the road from where Henry's Nonsuch Palace would have been. It was, of course, dismantled in the 17th century, and then they dug it up in the 60s and found the outline of it. So I used to go regularly to Nonsuch Park and went, in fact, to school at Nonsuch High School for girls from 11 to 16. So I feel like the seeds were being sown at an early age.
Absolutely.
And also just down the road from Hampton Court, so we went there when I was a child. And I loved history. I started loving it when I was about 11 years old, and there was a teacher, this is so trivial, this is such a child thing, who allowed us to put stickers on our books.
So that's so cute.
It started with that, and it started with storytelling. Mm-hmm. And anyway, just was a subject I loved, despite the fact that we were on a regime of studying Weimar Republic and the Nazis at 14, and then again at 16. But when I was deciding what to do as an A-level, I decided to do history, and then I had the most brilliant teachers. So A-level is the sort of 16 to 18-year-old high school degree here, not degrees, or a qualification here in the UK. And when I had the most amazing teachers, and particularly someone who was teaching me about the Russian Revolution, and it just really brought it to life. So I completely fell in love with it. And we also used to have these classes to think about sources and how you answered questions. And I suppose that started to invite me into the wonderful kind of detective work that's involved in history.
Absolutely.
You're figuring out what you can believe and what you can't. And so I ended up deciding to go for a university. So I applied to Lincoln College, Oxford. I remember my interviews. We had to do a little exam, and I had interviews. And I remember talking to them about Carlyle's great man theory of history that's been made by men. Anyway, and all sorts of other things. And I was lucky enough to get a place. And then my tutor was Susan Brigden.
Right.
So Susan Brigden, for those who don't know, is winner of the Wolfson Prize for her book on Thomas Wyatt a couple of years ago. A wonderful Tudor scholar, and happily still a friend. And she was just a great inspiration to me. So that's it in a nutshell, really.
Well, that's fabulous. I love that. Now, I thought we could jump right in, Susanna, and turn our attention to Henry VIII. Jump in the deep end. Now, undoubtedly, Henry is one of, if not the most famous figure of British history. He's notorious for having married six times and executed countless people, including childhood friends, relatives, two of his wives. I suppose in the popular mind, he's an overweight, paranoid, ruthless tyrant. But when Henry was crowned in June 1509, just 4 days short of his 18th birthday, he cut a very different figure. I was wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about sort of young Henry.
Yeah, well, certainly by the end of his life, he was that overweight, ruthless tyrant, paranoid, etc. And you're absolutely right to say that when he was crowned, he was just short of his 18th birthday. He was tall, good-looking, athletic, accomplished, charismatic, kind, everything you'd want in a prince, really, using that word in the Renaissance term, I mean, as a king. Mm-hmm. And so, well, funnily enough, the first book I ever wrote about Henry VIII was exactly looking at this question: how did he go from being that to being that peace and ruthless, paranoid tyrant? And, I mean, I think there's a number of explanations, but crucially, it seemed to me that there was a year in his life where things went really terribly wrong, which is, as you well know, 1536, which is
Absolutely.
The year that Catherine of Aragon died, which looked like good news at the time. But then, of course, Anne Boleyn was accused of adultery mm-hmm. with five men and executed. And I feel, and historians disagree with me, but I feel that the evidence suggests he was devastated by that. This woman he had moved heaven and earth to be with changed the very religion of the country to marry. And then suddenly she apparently has betrayed him with five men, including her brother. I mean, it's just so shocking. Mm. His eldest son, or his only son at this point, his illegitimate son, Henry Fitzroy, who he may have been thinking about to legitimate, died. There was a massive rebellion against him. Anyway, so on and so forth. And it's also the year, of course, in which he fell from his horse whilst jousting. And we don't know whether he bruised his cerebral cortex and whether we can look to that as an explanation for character change. But what he certainly did do is he opened up an ulcer on his leg that would never heal, gave him constant and debilitating pain for the rest of his life. And actually, I mean, in 1540, for example, there's an account from Charles de Marillac, the French ambassador, saying that they thought Henry was going to die. I mean, it's like a blood clot in the leg, you know, and it to his heart, and they feared a pulmonary embolism. And I think probably in the end, that is what killed him. So you know, he's in constant pain, which, you know, as we all know, when we get a bit irritable, not well, that you take that and write it large, and you've got something that's going on in Henry in that last decade. So it's a really interesting story of really profound character change, and I suppose bringing out some latent aspects of his character. Like, he was always egotistic, but the system got turned towards murderous ends as opposed to, you know, just showing off on his horse. So yeah. I think that's
Gosh, it's such a good story. I just love the story. And I was going to mention your book, but you've already touched on that, which is fantastic, because I did want to ask you...
Self-promotion, sorry.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely fine. I was going to ask you why that you were sort of drawn to write about that year in particular, but I think you've done really well at covering that. I also wanted to know, so there have been countless books, obviously, written about Henry, and we've touched on this, and about the fact that he's this sort of transformation from... the Renaissance prince, like you mentioned, to this kind of monster. But some of the interpretations, I suppose, that are out there, I find lack a little in the depth. So I wanted to hear more about the man that you came to know in your research. So even maybe pre-1536, what sort of man did you find there?
I will say, though, that the reason I started to write about it, just to sort of pick up on one thing you said there, was quite accidental. Right. I was working as a research curator at Hampton Court, very wonderful position I got after I was just finishing my doctorate. And somebody who was in charge of creating the visitor experience asked me, as the research curator, you know, to write a list of 10 important things that happened to Henry VIII in his life. 10 key events in his life. And, you know, I remember sort of grumbling about it and thinking how reductionist this was, you know, having to do this simple little exercise. And it was then that I realized that so many of them happened in the same year. And it was being asked to look at it in this different way that made me think, my goodness, what must that have been like to live through, the lived experience of that? Because so by that point, I felt like before I wrote that, two things happened in the historiography about Henry VIII. People either wrote about him thematically, so they would write about his religion, or, you know, they might write about, you know, his sporting career, or like there were these just kind of ways of tackling him and divvying it up.
Yep.
Or they would assume that he was always like that, like that he didn't really change, and that he'd been like that as a young man. But to come to your other part of the question, it really does look like in those early years he was a nice guy, right. Like that. So I mean, Sebastian Justinian, who was a Venetian ambassador who was at Henry's court between 1515 and 1519. I mean, I kind of think he had a crush on Henry. He says the most extraordinary things about him. He says that Henry was affable and gracious, a man who harmed no one. We have Erasmus, a man who harmed no one.
Yeah, no, believe. That's pretty funny.
We have Erasmus saying that he is gentle and companionship, you know, acts more like a companion, in fact, he says, than a king. We have Thomas More talking of Henry's way of making each man feel that he's enjoying his special favour.
Yes, and I love that one. I love that quote.
It is great, isn't it? Because it reminds me, you know, there are those people you meet who, when I remember there was a friend of mine at university who was like this. And when she spoke to you, it was like the sun was shining on you. You know,
Absolutely.
and then you turn away and you talk to somebody else, and you're like, oh. And I reckon that Henry must have been like that. He must have just been this extraordinary, charismatic person. And it's hard to get that through historical sources. You know, it's hard to capture that flavour. But I think Thomas More gets something of it there. And so, and then of course, good looking. I mean, he doesn't look that good looking to us in the pictures, but but standards of beauty change.
Absolutely,
so we have to go on
their
interpretation. And
good calves, by the way, right? Great calves.
Yeah, good legs, very important at the time. That's really interesting as well. They weren't interested in women's legs.
It's funny, isn't it?
And then, you know, just a great sportsman, capital horseman, fine jouster, surpassed all the archers of his guard at archery, you know, played tennis beautifully. Just, you know, had, and at the time, and the reason this is important is because they understood things in a very literal way at the time. They understood that if you were meant to be king, you would look like a king.
Absolutely.
You know, so the fact that Henry is about 5 inches taller than the average man means he looks like he has all the bearings of a king. So he inspires confidence.
Absolutely. That's, very true. Now, I want to talk about your other book now. So The King is Dead, The Last Will and Testament of Henry VIII. Could you just tell us a little bit about how this book came about?
Yes, so the publisher, Head of Zeus, wanted to do a series of books on documents, and Dan Jones had already written the one on Magna Carta. And so, it started as an idea of just a sort of a little simple book on Henry VIII's will. This looked like a fairly straightforward endeavor. And then as I sort of started to get into the research, trying to go into it with an open mind. So when I'd written about 1536, I'd ended up disagreeing with a number of historians who felt that what was going on in that year was a result of factions, so groups at court manoeuvring to make Henry do things. And it felt like in 1536, no one could really make Henry do anything. I mean, you could try and suggest things to him, but he was very much his own man.
Right.
And I thought, well, you know, okay, it might be that by the end of his life, when he's become this sort of doddering old man, he is being led around by the nose. Maybe things change. Maybe he, the result of his aging and his illness. And that was generally the sort of party line. The consensus was that actually Henry VIII's will had been the product of a coup that had been staged by an evangelical faction. So evangelical meant those who were more inclined towards Protestantism at the court, and that they sort of pushed all the more conservative in religion, people like the Duke of Norfolk and Thomas Gardiner, Bishop of Winchester, out of the way in Henry's will so that they could seize power when Henry died.
Right.
So that's the sort that we got. That's why I'm going into it under. And funnily enough, when I met Susan Brigden again for a lunch just before I started working on it, she said, "Oh, well, it's the story of a conspiracy, isn't it?" I don't know now whether she said it with a bit of a twinkle in her eye.
Right.
I sort of wonder, because of course, what I found is that the conspiracy theory just didn't stand up to scrutiny.
Right.
That once you start to look at the evidence, it all sort of dissolves before your very eyes, and that a lot of the as it happens a lot in Tudor history, as you all know, a lot of the conclusions had been reached by running ahead of the evidence, kind of a sort of wishful thinking. Wouldn't it be good if this was the story?
Yeah.
And that once you actually dismantle that and sort of look at it piece by piece and take it, you know, like a taking a clock apart and looking at the workings, it's just doesn't make sense. There's some serious errors of scholarship, or even one could go so far as to say mistruths that were a part of this story of the conspiracy. And actually I found, to cut a long story short, in the end, Henry is very much his own master in those last days as well, and that his last will and testament was literally his will. It was the product of his own volition.
Oh, wow. Okay. Now, talking about Henry's death. Now, at the time of Henry's death, it was in fact treason to speak of the king's death. So I want to talk about, if you could tell us a little bit about the brave soul who took on the perilous and completely and utterly unenviable task of telling Henry to prepare his soul for death.
Yes. This was Sir Anthony Denny, chief gentleman of the Privy Chamber, and he was a man who, you know, was brave, because, as you say, it was absolutely illegal to, under the act that had been passed 13 years earlier, it was treason to speak of the king's death. Yeah. And so you can imagine on that night, it was the 27th of January, 1547, those who were gathered around the king's bed must have sort of been terrified, thinking, you know, who's going to tell him?
Who's going to do it? Yeah.
Their Christian duty is to help him prepare his soul to meet his maker. And in the end, sweet, gentle Denny, as he's known, decides to risk it and whispers to the king, and, you know, obviously cares enough about the king's fate to risk his own, and whispers to the king, you know, you need to prepare for death, and asks him if he wants a priest. And Henry asks for Cranmer. And I think that's really interesting as well, because Cranmer, of course, had been so important, you know, the architect of Henry's reign in some ways, you know, of the ability for him to separate from the Church of Rome, his marriage to Anne Boleyn, the dissolution of his marriage to Catherine of Aragon, had been utterly crucial along the way. And at the very end, it's Cranmer that he puts his faith in.
Wow, amazing. Now, it's difficult to talk about Henry, well, for me anyway, without mentioning Anne Boleyn. So I have to ask you, Susanna, the million-dollar question, although I think it's probably worth a lot more by now, so maybe the billion-dollar question, why did she have to die?
Yes.
It's the biggie, okay, the biggie.
All right, okay. Limber up. How can I do this quickly? Right, so, okay, so I should say, first of all, that historians are divided on this.
It's absolutely. So your opinion, yeah. What's your opinion?
So my opinion is that it wasn't Henry's intention to get rid of her. I don't buy the, you know, off of the head, because I don't think that when she died, he was already a monster. I think he becomes a monster later. That's not quite the only reason, but also that's part of it. Also, I don't think it was a court coup by Thomas Cromwell, because the evidence is very flimsy for that. In fact, the one piece of evidence in which it hangs, again, put in context, falls apart. I don't think she was guilty, which some people suggest. Really very little evidence, apart from the confession of Mark Smeaton, who was this conjurer at the court, as you know, and I think was probably tortured. And so, and also, I think, was vulnerable. He was either young or simple, I'd say, because he is one of these men who's in receipt of the Bouche of Court. And the only other people on this list at the time, I mean, lots of people have Bouche of Court, but the only people on the list that he's on are either young musicians, boy musicians at the court, or Henry's fools. So he's either very young, or he's considered to be somewhat simple. Anyway, he confesses, no one else does. So having put those three theories aside, one is left with the fact that what actually happened is a sort of almighty cock-up. Anne's friend, stretching that word slightly, and gentlewoman, Elizabeth Brown, is Countess of Worcester, is talking to her brother, Anthony Brown, and this comes from a poem by Lancelot de Carle, and he accuses her of loose living. She's pregnant, and to paraphrase, she says, "If you think I'm bad, you should see the Queen." She entertains men in her rooms late at night, including her brother and, you know, Mark and Henry Norris. And if we're to believe this account, Anthony Brown goes and tells Cromwell and Sir William Fitzwilliam, and they tell the king. And Henry was completely shocked by the allegation. I mean, this is sort of prefiguring, of course, what happens when Cranmer has to tell Henry about Catherine Howard's more probable adultery, I think. And Henry is, you know, obviously horrified. Obviously horrified. And orders an investigation. And this fits with what Cromwell says about it, that Henry authorised him and commissioned him to investigate and to bring about the matter of a trial. And there's one line that's only in this de Carle's source from June 1536 and not repeated elsewhere, but very important if it's true, which is that Cromwell is told that it will be, if it turns out not to be true.
Ah, yes, yes, yeah.
It will be on pain of death for the person who has brought this slanderous accusation to the king's ears, which of course is Cromwell.
Gosh.
So yeah. I feel I've always felt that really loaded the dice. It meant that Henry, you know, if you know Henry's going to kill you.
Yes, exactly. No, I agree.
Of her guilt.
Yeah.
And what Cromwell does is very sensible. He picks on Mark Smeaton. He interrogates him, possibly under torture. The accounts vary. And Smeaton confesses. And that gives everything this kind of irresistible presumption of guilt. Mm. So my sense is that what Anne has done has played her role as the queen at the heart of a courtly love court to perfection.
Mm.
Perhaps a little too well. And I think it had been her absolute skill at this game, this sort of game of flirtatious love talk, that had attracted Henry to her in the first place. Mm. Her ability, her dancing, her sophistication, her wit in wordplay, much more than her beauty, actually. And it is this that is her undoing, because then we have accounts. We don't have the trial documents for Anne Boleyn's trial. We only have the indictment.
Right.
Very frustrating. But we have also letters from Sir William Kingston, who was the constable in the Tower. He sent these letters to Cromwell, reporting back on everything Anne said for the 3 weeks that she was imprisoned in the Tower. And when she was in the Tower, she talked about conversations she'd had with the men of the court, obviously not thinking that what she was saying was being written down, and obviously probably thinking that what she was saying was perfectly above board.
Mm.
But what she's, you know, but what she reports are conversations that you can only really interpret as courtly love conversations, and they, I think, must be what's used against her. And the reason I think this is because one of them was a conversation with Henry Norris, the king's best friend, in which she had said to him this famous line, "You look for different shoes, for if aught came to the king but good, you would look to have me." And as we've said, it's treason to speak of the king's death. And this is speaking of the king's death. And it's the only thing that I can find in the sources that explains why Anne is accused of conspiring the king's death, which is she has to be accused of, by the way, because it's the only thing that's treasonous. That's adultery and incest aren't treasonous.
Absolutely. Anyway, so do you think that when Cromwell heard of that, he did a bit of a sort of air punch and was like, "Yes, I've got her now." Kind
of absolutely. Thing. Got her on the hook. Got her.
Oh, yeah. Goodness gracious. Okay. Now, when I actually posted about that I was going to talk to you in a Facebook group that I started, Talking Tudors Podcast, that people can join on Facebook, and a couple of people had some questions for you. So do you mind, Susanna, if I read them out to you?
Go for it.
So Beth von Statz, the lovely Beth von Statz, she says, "Can you please ask Susanna about her groundbreaking research of innocent fools, people with cognitive challenges that lived at the Tudor court, because she finds that so fascinating." Do you mind touching on that one?
Yes, and I haven't really published on it as well, which is annoying. I should
get around to it. Be upcoming.
Yes. So this came out of a project I did several years ago with a company of actors with learning disabilities and a man called Pete Cooper, who has for a long time played the fool at Hampton Court and other places. And it's really interesting. It seems that by the end of the 16th century, we have the terms natural fool and artificial fool in operation. So a natural fool is somebody who is naturally foolish. So whereas an artificial fool is somebody who is mimicking by art that foolishness. So a sort of a clown, an actor, a professional. But I realised that early in the 16th century, the language used is slightly different. So when they say fool, they mean what later becomes to mean natural fool. I have lots of evidence behind this. I can't explain it all in this.
That's okay. No, no, of course.
And jester, which means artificial fool. So we have Tom the jester at Henry's court, but we also have fools like Will Sommer and Patch and a number of others who appear in not only in their behaviour, but also in terms of how they are looked after to be foolish. So Will Sommer, for example, who is one of the king's closest companions, is described as having a keeper. And Tom the Jester doesn't have a keeper. He gets payments of money directly to him, whereas Will Sommer has somebody who is paid to look after him, who provides for his food, who provides his clothing. It's basically a carer in modern language. Okay. And so what's interesting about these fools is that, using very different language, it seems that they are talking about people with learning disabilities who are, in contrast to many other courts, so not like the Scottish court and the French court act completely differently, but the English court seems to, and Henry VIII in particular, seems to value these fools as being oracles of wisdom, as through their innocence being kind of in connection with the divine, and being a source of merriment. So it's said that when Henry was melancholy, which he often was, it was Will Sommer that was the one he turned to at that moment. And then we see this really powerfully and visually in that beautiful picture of the family of Henry VIII at Hampton Court, where from 1545, you can think of it, you picture it in your head. Henry sat in the middle there with Edward on one side, and then Mary and Elizabeth a bit further off, and then in the arches we have two other characters just outside the court but of the picture, and one of them is Will Sommer and the other is Jane, the Queen's fool. So the fact that we've got these fools included in this dynastic portrait, I think, says a lot about their status in court.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. So Lisa asked, who are Susanna's most and least favourite tutors and why? So your most favourite tutor, your least favourite tutor.
I'm very fond of Catherine Parr. Okay. I think that she doesn't always get the billing she deserves. She's been a bit written off, and I think she was phenomenally intelligent and interesting. You know, I like the fact that she writes books but also buys beautiful silks and perfumes. She's just like a woman after my own heart. And she's also a great patron to the arts. And so I find her really interesting. And then I'm another great fan of Thomas Wyatt, the poet, the younger. I love Wyatt's poetry, some of my favourite poetry in all of English literature. And and I think he's a very interesting character. So that's why I love Susan Brigham's book on him. I think there's so much to learn about him that's fascinating. It's difficult to say. I have really complex relationships with, say, Henry and Anne Boleyn. I can't even really summarise them in a nutshell. My least favourite. Gosh, that's tricky.
It's a tricky one, isn't it? Yeah.
Because even people I don't really like, Chapuis, for example, but, you know, I'm totally reliant on his evidence.
That's true.
He's the imperial ambassador at the court, and he's a total gossip. I mean, he's the sort of person who writes down smart. He'd write for one of the tabloid newspapers if he was alive today. And he loves these colourful, sensational stories. But, you know, God bless him. I'm glad that he wrote them down.
Absolutely.
And I think probably we have to go a bit further on. I'm not a big fan of Gardner. I think Gardner's probably quite prissy and self-important and a bit of a bore, really. I mean, he's also bright and everything, but I think he would have been a pain in the ass to spend time with.
All right, fantastic. Thank you. Now, as I think you know, Suzanne, I love to explore the story of the Tudors through the actual houses and buildings and palaces where this amazing story played out. So I wanted to know, what's one of your favourite lesser-known Tudor locations? So we know the Hampton Court. We all love Hampton Court. What's a lesser-known, a little hidden gem that you love?
Let's see, what would I recommend? I mean, I should imagine none of them will be lesser-known for you, Natalie, but I also at one point wrote about 50 places around that you could go and explore this in. And one of them would be, I mean, this is kind of medium well known, but I love Thornbury Castle. Which is in Gloucestershire, which was the house of the Duke of Buckingham, and is half built. And I love the fact well, it's a bit gory to love it, but it's what's really interesting is that in stonework it plays out the Duke of Buckingham's instructions. He was executed in 1521 by Henry VIII because he'd been listening to prophecies that he would one day be king, mm-hmm. and also mm-hmm. because he, you know, Henry feared that he was going to try and make that happen by gathering up his tenants to be his army and building this house which looks like a fortress. And so if you go and look at it today, it's now a very fancy hotel, you can see the sort of half completed North Range, which would have been his soldiers' barracks, and you can see the towers, a tower in which Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn stayed, no less, and the fact that the other ones that he planned are not there. Mm. I find that a really interesting one.
It is beautiful, yeah, and the gardens are incredible there.
Beautiful oriel windows in those gardens as well.
Yeah,
really lovely place. I don't know if that's quite small enough for you, though.
No, that's absolutely fine.
Okay,
that's all.
There are always some others coming. Teeming my mind, but I could keep you talking for ages.
No, so are you currently working, can you reveal, I don't know if you can tell us, but are you currently working on any new books, any new Tudor books?
Well, I've got three, actually. So one tiny little book. I'll show you because we can see each other.
We can see
each other. So this is a little book on witchcraft for Ladybird Expert. When I say little, I mean 6,000 words. So, but it's beautifully illustrated, and so that's about witchcraft in... across Europe in the 16th and 17th centuries, and you know why it happened and why women were accused of it in the main, and you know what the hell was going on there. Mm-hmm. So that's coming out in October, and then I've got a big book coming out in January, which I'm really proud of. I put my heart and soul into, which is about women in 16th century France, and very much when we think about people in the 16th century, we know about these headline characters, we know about the Anne Boleyns, and we know about Henry VIII and Elizabeth, but these are ordinary women. These are the sort of wives of the butchers and the bakers, and what I discovered through these incredible sources are from a moral court that was where the Protestants converted people, where they settled, they established these moral courts. They would interrogate women because basically if morals, reforming morals means reforming women.
Yeah.
And so we have incredible sources where women went before these courts called consistories and explained what they'd been up to, what they'd been doing, what they believed, you know, their thoughts, their motivations. And this is this incredible insight into ordinary people's lives, ordinary women's lives in the 16th century. When most women who ever lived, and most women who ever lived in the 16th century, you know, left nothing to posterity. They couldn't read or write. We don't have any letters. We don't have diaries. And so I found these sources, which I think I'm like the third or fourth historian to ever look at, and nobody has looked at them write about. People have only ever written, so there's a great French historian who wrote a big four-volume thesis about the working of the Protestant church, and a couple of other people have looked at the first two volumes. Anyway, I've looked at 25 volumes.
Oh, my goodness.
1,200 morals cases, and they tell us loads about women and how much more powerful they were than we have thought, ordinary women, and how much more vocal and resourceful and violent. And that's so that's been really extraordinary, and that's coming out in January. And then after that, I am returning completely to the Tudor court, and I am writing my version of on Henry VIII's wives. So
fantastic.
I'm writing a book.
I can't wait. That's so exciting. And I don't know how you managed to do it all, to be honest. That's just, how do you fit it all in? When do you write? Do you have a time that you write? Or?
Well, my life tends to be constantly changing in terms of what I'm doing on any given day. When I'm writing, I tend to write in the mornings when my brain is at its freshest, and then try and do other things in the afternoon. But when I was finishing the last book, you know, by the last 2 months, all I'm doing is writing, and it's all I'm doing, evening, morning, and night. And so at the moment, I'm just in a little bit of a lull. I say a lull. So I'm writing just magazine articles, journal articles, and things like that, and just been filming something. And then, but come September, I crack on again with teaching and with writing the next book. So.
Oh, fantastic. Now, Let me see. I think, Susanna, it's time for us to play 10 to go. Are you ready?
I'll do my best.
I got my questions. Now, I have to say, I have to confess to our listeners, Susanna and I can see each other. We're on Skype, and I'm wearing my pajamas. How sad is that? I thought we were going to do audio. And last minute, and Susanna's right, so much nicer to see each other. But after all these years of wanting to talk face-to-face with Susanna, I'm wearing my PJs. I love it. It's just the funniest thing ever.
It's late at night there. It's early in the morning here.
It's winter here, Susanna. Don't forget, it's winter. So it's chilly for us Aussies. We're all rugged up. But anyway, I had to confess. I like confessing things. All right. So, Susanna, name two items on your bucket list. Do you have a bucket list?
Well, I'm going to do one in the next few weeks, actually, which is I'm going to go to Yosemite in California. So American national parks are basically a great fascination of mine. So I'm going to a couple of them. I'm going to go to see the Redwoods, and I'm going to Yosemite. So I'm preparing myself for the bucket. But, what else is on my bucket list? Oh, gosh, so many things. I'd like to learn to sing properly. I think that would be really nice.
So do you sing at all? Or?
I sang when I was a child. So I was in a choir at school and in a small jazz and blues a cappella group. But it's been years and years since I did that. And I think, for absolutely no sort of purposeful reason, but just for the sheer fun of it, it would be nice to learn to sing properly.
Lovely. All right. I like that. Now, what do you do to recharge? You're obviously very busy. What do you do when you just want to recharge the batteries?
So let me see. I love yoga. I've recently started the Israeli self-defense called Krav Maga.
Okay.
I love going walking as well. I really like to get into the countryside. I live in London and I like to get out and see trees and walk. And other than that, I just have wonderful friends I hang out with and eat good food, quite a foodie, and like cooking, and I like hanging out with my husband and my cats, really. I mean,
sounds lovely. I'm a real homebody too. Do you have a song that instantly lifts your mood? So if you're feeling a bit down, a bit low, do you have anything that just gives you that little buzz?
This is it's actually would be Schubert. It would be Schubert's The Trout Quintet. I find that always makes me happy.
All right, I have to listen to that. So what's an early childhood memory for you? Earliest, if you can remember an earliest, or just an early childhood memory?
One of the earliest I can remember is a duffel coat that my mother tells me I would have had when I was about 2 or 3. So it was blue with toggles. I think it maybe have been red inside. I may be imagining that. And I just remember the toggles. And my mother made it.
Oh, that's really cute. What are you currently reading? You're probably reading a lot of things. What's one of the books that you're currently reading?
I am reading the most amazing book, actually. I must tell you, it's called King Leopold's Ghost, which is an incredible book by Adam Hochschild, which is the history of the Belgian Congo and the founding of the Congo. And it is a searing, brutal, incredible story that I was shamefully unaware of in terms of the sort of late 19th century, the treatment of the native peoples of the Congo in the establishment of the independent state of the Congo, basically run by Leopold of Belgium himself. So I highly recommend that. King Leopold's.
Fantastic. Thank you. My TBR list is just growing. What is your guilty pleasure?
Don't believe in guilty pleasures. I don't believe pleasures are guilty. So I throw back on that. But
Absolutely. Yep.
Let's see. Having said that they're not guilty, I mean, I am. I basically love a really good glass of red wine. I mean, that's a nice Bordeaux. That sets me up.
Yum. That sounds good right about now, actually. I was going to say, what's your drink of choice? If someone's taking you out for a drink, would that be it?
That would be it. It's sort of open. If people want to give me drinks, they're most welcome to. I won't object to what it is. In summer, rosé, something from Provence would be perfectly acceptable instead. And to be honest, at this type of the morning here, coffee. I'm a coffee fiend.
You're a coffee lady. Very good. Now, you mentioned your singing, that you wanted to do a bit more singing. Do you have a go-to karaoke song?
I don't know. I mean, probably like something like Summertime. Mm-hmm. That's quite a difficult one to do. I'm sure I could come up with something more easy. I don't have a go-to one, that's for sure. I need to obviously need to work on my karaoke.
You need to do a bit more karaoke. Yeah, exactly. All right. I don't know if I'm up to 9 or 10, but I'm going to go for another one. What characteristics do you most value in others?
Loyalty, honesty, kindness. Hmm. Kindness above all, I suppose. Speaking good words about people when it's around. Obviously, you don't want your friends to only ever speak good words about people, because otherwise you feel like a terrible, horrible person yourself. But you mostly want them to be these kind of uplifting, kind and generous and warm-spirited people.
Oh, that sounds, yeah, that's lovely. I agree with you. Kindness is very important. I would add, if it was my list, humility as well. I love
humility. I completely agree, actually.
Another beautiful thing.
It counts for a lot. It's a very good quality.
It certainly does. Now, I could just keep talking to you all day, but you've probably got things to do. So I'm going to ask you, Susanna, for your Tudor takeaway, something for our listeners to go and have a look at or listen to or read of after the episode.
Okay, so this is, it's kind of in two parts because it depends where your listeners are.
Okay.
So very exciting project I've been working on over the summer is an exhibition called We Are Bess, which is about Bess of Hardwick, and it opens in October at Hardwick Hall in Derbyshire. And what we've got is, I'm so excited about this, is we've got modern women giving their perspective on Bess of Hardwick's life. And part of the reason for this is that much of what we know about Bess of Hardwick, who became the second richest woman under Elizabeth I, and married four times, much of it comes from her estranged fourth husband. And as you can imagine, what an ex has to say about you is not particularly flattering. So it's quite misogynistic. And it's been, and throughout history, what's been passed down from historian to historian, even replicated by some very good historians in our period, has been these quite gendered, loaded analysis of Bess. So we've stripped that all back and tried to get back to her voice and tried to think about who Bess really was. And to help us with that, we've asked a number of modern women, so some of them historians, like Mary Beard, Professor Dame Mary Beard, some of them the people who are well known in the public eye, to and then also a range of local Derbyshire women to comment on their this story of Bess, and with their photographs and their comments will hang among the Tudor portraits in the Long Gallery at Hardwick Hall. So go and see that in November or October, or it will run February to June next year as well. Then that's a National Trust exhibition. Mm-hmm. Or if you can't get there, here's another takeaway, which is about Bess, which is that the University of Glasgow some years ago did transcribed all her letters and put them online. So it's at bessofhardwick.org, and you can go and read this woman's letters and the letters to her and her own voice. And it's just an incredible research resource that's just sitting there on the internet for anyone to go and have a look at.
I don't know that I've ever heard about that before. That's fantastic.
If you want to go and hear about a woman from the 16th century and read her own words, then bessofhardwick.org is where to go.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Susanna. This has been such a delight and a pleasure. I'm so happy that you made time to chat with me, and I think our listeners are really going to enjoy this episode.
Thank you. I'm not sure they're that interested in hearing about my, you know, my singing ambition, but
Oh, don't worry. There's always... We always veer onto some. I think the last one I recorded, somehow we ended up chatting about Diet Coke for a few minutes. So I don't know how that occurred. So there's always something in there, which I think makes it a lot of fun. So I hope you have a lovely day.
Thank you. And I hope you have a lovely night.
Yeah. Now that I'm in my PJs, ready for bed. All right. Thanks, Susanna. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for listening. If you have any comments or suggestions, or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, where you'll also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family, and click on the all-important follow button so you'll never miss an episode. I also invite you to join our Talking Tudors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.